Bring arms.
Yes, but I am only saying that, since no one checks the hook, either of you could cheat and we would not know.
I unhooked from my foot restraints to turn and give him one of my mother's patented cold, polite glares. I thought I was practicing a skill that would keep my team alive. Cheating isn't something that even occurred to me. Why? I wonder what made you think of it. From the flush that rose to his cheeks, I may have put a tiny bit too much emphasis on the you. Binkowski clapped a hand on his co-pilot's shoulder.
You haven't known York as long as I have. There's a damn good reason we don't bother to check her numbers. Yaya, the lady astronaut.
De Beer gave a smile and a little bow.
I know, I know. It is only my competitive nature. I meant nothing by it.
Heidi met my gaze with a little twitch of her eyebrows. De Beer must be a joy to work with in Sims if he questioned her all the time. And she'd be spending 3 years with the man? Suddenly I had a new appreciation for Parker, who never, ever questioned me in my area of expertise. I pushed off from the wall to float over to the Nina group. Who's up next?
Gray.
Parker gave a little wave to Florence.
Have at it.
The theory was that we all needed to be versed in how to use the sextant, just in case something happened to me or Heidi. But the practice meant that Parker was pulling Florence out into the focal range of De Beer, a man who loathed her existence in general and her presence on the mission in specific. After 3 months in space with both teams mixing, I'd gotten to know the Pinta team better than we would have if we'd been running parallel training tracks on Earth. De Beer was a product of South Africa and a firm believer in the value of apartheid. He'd also been on the rocket that had gone off course, and I would place solid bets that he'd been the one to lie to the FBI. So Parker suggesting that Florence have a go now was either cruel to her or a dig at De Beer. Actually, knowing him, it was probably both. Florence drifted out from behind our group where she and Leonard had been watching. Her jaw was set, and she kept her gaze fixed on the rail where I'd been anchored. I held out my sextant. Florence took it with a nod. Binkowski traded a look with Parker. I couldn't guess at what passed between them, but he turned to De Beer.
Say, why don't you go next?
De Beer nodded, but also muttered something in Afrikaans.
Tin die octopus op.
Parker gave one push with his toes and bounded across the room to land with military accuracy in front of De Beer. His voice was clipped with equal military precision.
Achtend dat offensief, zweret weer, en ach krij jij permanent gegrond.
Recoiling, De Beer overcompensated and flailed comically backward. Binkowski stuck out a hand to right his co-pilot, shaking his head at Parker.
Jesus Christ, Afrikaans now too?
I like languages. What can I say?
Parker shrugged, back to the charming, shit-eating, aw-shucks astronaut hero that he showed the American public. Heidi laughed and handed her sextant to De Beers.
Wie viele macht das?
Parker cocked his head to the side, his fingers twitching as if he were counting on them.
Elf? Nein, zwölf. Zwölf, aber ich bin wirklich nur Konversation in sechs oder sieben von Ihnen.
Heidi laughed again, and it was easy to see why Switzerland had chosen Heidi as its poster child for the space program. Perfect teeth, a swan's neck, capped by a braided coil of golden hair.
Only six or seven, he says.
As De Beer hooked into the restraint next to Florence, he busied himself with Heidi's sextant.
How long have you had Afrikaans?
Started learning at the moment you were assigned to the Mars mission.
I am flattered.
De Beer said.
It was the only one I didn't have already.
Parker shrugged.
Of course, I learned Taiwanese for no reason.
I winced at his not-so-subtle reminder of Helen. But have you learned Yiddish?
Yiddish? Not Judeo-Spanish? I thought your family was from Charleston.
I blinked at him while my brain struggled with which part of that was the most surprising. Was it the fact that Parker knew where my family was from? The fact that he knew that Charleston was mostly Sephardic Jews, not Ashkenazi. Or that he knew that not all Jews spoke the same language. Yeah. Came over in the 1700s from Germany? How did you know? I'm not sure which question I wanted answered.
My mother-in-law is Jewish, Sephardic by way of Holland.
He glanced past me, and a scowl surfaced for a moment before getting plastered over with a grin.
Incoming.
Parker pushed off and did a showy somersault over my head to land neatly by the door to the observation room, where Betty was shepherding in our reporting pool. God damn it. They were early. Hooking his feet under one of the guide rails, Parker did a nice imitation of someone standing at parade rest, even with the zero-G. Around me, 12 astronauts snapped on their regulation smiles. You would think that being off the planet, I'd have escaped the orbit of the press. You would be wrong. Every country that had invested money in the Mars expedition wanted news of it. The shenanigans that Nathaniel and Clemens had pulled to get us off planet earlier had gotten us away from congressional hearings, but not the need to keep money flowing toward the IAC's coffers. I didn't even want to know what it took to get the press pool certified for space travel. I pushed off to join Parker in greeting the press corps, hopefully giving the rest of our team breathing room to keep working with their sextants. After all, being a face for the public was why I was on the mission. At the front of the group, trailing Betty, was, joy of joys, Jerry, the photographer from the Times. Maybe I could get him to take Parker's photo with a single punch card. Betty spun in place and smiled at her charges. We did so much smiling for the public.
Oh my, this is lucky. May I introduce the first man into space, Colonel Stetson Parker.
When she gestured to him, Parker grinned and waved.
And of course, Dr. Elma York, better known as the Lady Astronaut.
Smile and wave. Smile and wave. My job was to make space look as glamorous and exciting as possible. It would be a chore since at least two of the reporters looked green with the early signs of space sickness. With my luck, one of them would chalk any vomiting up to space germs instead of good old-fashioned vertigo. I padded a pocket on my flight suit for the reassuring crinkle of a vomit bag. Welcome to Lunetta!
We're so pleased you could join us.
Parker had the aw shucks thing down pat.
Hope your flight up was uneventful.
Betty, what do you have on the agenda for these fine folks?
I thought that they might want to take a look at the observation lounge while their luggage was being offloaded, but I didn't realize you all were in here.
That was not true, since we'd discussed this trip at the Monday morning staff meeting. This little exercise was so they'd feel like there was some spontaneity to our dog and pony show. Funny what people respond to.
We're practicing using sextants, but you're welcome to watch.
Parker turned to gesture to the window where Florence was at work.
We're spicing things up a little by making it into a contest.
Here's a question. Did Parker plan to have Florence be the subject of photographs, or was that an accident? It's hard to tell with him, but I was pleased she was getting the spotlight right now, especially with the news from Earth about the sit-ins at the launch centers.
Sounds fun, but it's not the view I promised you. Sorry, folks.
Betty's curls bobbed freely as if she were underwater.
If any of you want to head back to your quarters, one of the crew can escort you straight there.
If she'd said cash bar, then we might have lost some of the reporters, but otherwise, none of them were going to risk being scooped. She knew that. Their cameras were already out and snapping away.
Well, we'll get back to the contest then.
Parker pushed off, and I followed him back to the group of Niña astronauts. He stopped and hung upside down this time. You'd think that up and down shouldn't have any meaning here, but we tend to orient in the same direction because back on Earth, we train in gravity. The engineers install labels in gravity. The lights are overhead because of gravity. Also, there's the courtesy of making it easier to read facial expressions. We don't have gravity, but we do have up and down. I glanced at him. You want to disorient them immediately?
I'm trying to provide a vivid photographic opportunity for the press corps.
Camila Shamoon, our medic, rolled her eyes.
If you fart, I swear to God I'm going to light it.
That's terrible for propulsion.
Parker pulled out his stopwatch.
Okay, what's their goal? Benkoski?
The pilot for the Pinta team shook his head.
York, you won the last round. You pick.
Good call. Then she can go back and explain it to the peanut gallery.
Parker nodded and stared at me expectantly from upside down. I considered for a moment. Let's have the state vector for Lunetta using Deneb and Aldebaran for guidance. While they worked, I kicked back to the press corps who snapped photos, or rather, tried to snap photos. Most of them had forgotten to anchor, and one clearly hadn't yet learned to conserve movement, so not only was he floating free, he was also spinning. I snagged the lanky blonde man and helped him settle. Keeping a hand on the reporter, I smiled at the rest of the group. Can I answer any questions for you? A reporter with a movie star mane of dark hair raised his hand.
Justino Coroneu, of Folha de São Paulo. What are we over now?
Good question. I gestured to the wall of windows to the right of the door. Follow a guide rail over here and we'll take a look. We orbit the Earth about every 90 minutes. But since we're not oriented on the ecliptic, we see a slightly different part of the planet with each revolution. I kicked off with my toes and flew down to the window, rebounding off of it to change orientation and face them.
Is that safe?
The Times reporter hung back a little. Absolutely. Unless a meteor passed by, but there wasn't any point in alarming them. I snagged a hand grip to anchor myself. Each window has four panes of glass that are each 3 centimeters thick. So there's 12 centimeters between you and outer space. A 91-kilogram man could stand on this on Earth and even jump up and down without problems. In zero-G, I weigh significantly less than that. The Times reporter raised his camera as if he couldn't help himself.
Is that to protect against meteors?
An impact with someone's lunchbox is more likely. I smiled. Again. And looked down to where the Earth spun past us in glorious blues and silver grays. Flashes of brown or green land peeked through the cloud cover like secret promises. We're over Africa right now. A lanky blonde man pushed himself to the front of the pack.
Home.
His broad accent placed him at the bottom of the continent. He raised his camera and started snapping photos.
Do you think I could get Vanderbilt to bear in front of South Africa?
By the time he finishes, we'll have rotated off of it, I'm afraid. I glanced over to the cluster where Florence and De Beer worked. Our next orbit should still be over the landmass, though.
Alas.
The reporter straightened, and it sent him careening up and away from the windows. I snagged his foot and guided him to one of the rails. Careful there. Make sure you always keep a hand on something until you get used to zero-G.
How long did it take you?
The Brazilian reporter had one hand on a rail and used the other to steady his camera. I shrugged. By the second or third day, I was fairly comfortable, but it's different for everyone. I gestured to the group of astronauts. For instance, Graham Stueman, who is the geologist for the Pinta, was an Olympic diver before going into geology. He took to space as if it were water. Derek Binkowski, the Pinta's pilot, had done skydiving with the Air Force, and that experience seemed to translate to weightlessness.
What about the other geologist?
The South African reporter had lifted his camera toward the group and adjusted the focus, but didn't snap a picture. Dr. Flannery was about average. Though, in truth, one of the criteria that the IAC looked for in Mars Expedition candidates was our resilience to space sickness. All of their heads snapped around toward me. One of the greenish men gurgled and swallowed with an audible gulp.
Space sickness? Like the disease that the astronauts had on the rocket that crashed?
It is sometimes difficult not to laugh outright at people, but honestly, weren't reporters supposed to know better? If you're thinking of something microbial, there's no such thing. What astronauts are afflicted with is a disturbance of the vestibular system in the inner ear. It is annoying but not dangerous. Think of it like seasickness. In near unison, most of the reporters exchanged their cameras for pads of paper and dutifully wrote something down. That would probably translate to something like, Elma York says that space sickness is like seasickness. It could be worse.
Speaking of crashed rockets, are you comfortable with Leonard Flannery's continued involvement in the expedition, considering that he is under investigation for the crash of the Cygnus 14 rocket?
This was the South African reporter again. Years of anxiety gave me the ability to look calm and smile even when my heart started racing, though this time it was from anger. Leonard was inside the rocket, same as I was, and couldn't have had anything to do with the crash, so I'm absolutely fine with having him on the crew. Among other things, he literally wrote the book on the Martian landscape.
What about his EVA?
I blinked, which seems to be what I do when I'm surprised. I blinked again. Excuse me?
According to sources, Leonard Flannery did an EVA practice the morning before the Cygnus 14 rocket returned to Earth. Couldn't he have damaged the ship then?
According to sources? The only good thing coming out of this circus was that it narrowed down our likely subjects for the person who was talking to the FBI. If they shared a source with the South African reporter, then it stood to reason that the South African astronaut was the link. Vanderbilt De Beer. He and I were going to have a very interesting talk. 11.
What kind of men are they? The crew of the Mars expedition. July 19th, 1962, Time Magazine. Colonel Stetson Parker walked into the room, a conservative plaid sports jacket draping his well-proportioned 5'11 frame, giving an immediate impression of suave urbanity. His disappearing blonde hair, once thick, is closely cropped, accentuating his strong jaw. His lopsided grin suggested he was aware of his role as an historic figure and was trying hard to make people remember that he was just a man. It is easy to be blinded by his role as the first man into space and forget that beneath this charming exterior is a skilled fighter pilot who flew more than 80 missions in the Second World War.
After a day of trying to catch De Beer without any of the others around, I had enough time to calm down and realize that I should talk to Florence and Leonard first. Leonard was in his lab experimenting on something. There were rocks and a drill. Anyway, I went to track down Florence and found her in the gym, running on the treadmill under the gentle centrifugal gravity of Lunetta's spinning donut. I walked across the gently curving floor, past Terrazas at the weights and Rafael on the stationary bike. Some of the regular Lunetta crew were also there, wearing their UN-issued workout clothes. A reporter slouched in the corner taking pictures of De Beer while he did push-ups. Florence had a towel draped over her shoulder and wiped her face as she ran. Even with the artificial gravity of the spinning section of Lunetta, sweat did not drip quite as quickly as it did on Earth. She gave me a little nod to acknowledge that she'd seen me, but kept running. "Can I borrow you for a bit?" I glanced at the others, but no one seemed to care that we were talking. "There's a comm question I could use help with for the next sim." Florence wiped her face.
"Got another 20 minutes on the treadmill."
I nodded and shot a glance briefly at De Beer to make sure he was still showing off for the reporter. "Okay. I'll be in the lab going over something with Leonard when you get a chance." She followed my gaze and raised her eyebrows. Pursing her lips, Florence nodded. "I'll come by." Dr. Leonard Flannery looked every bit the mad scientist when I walked into the lab. He had on a white lab coat, safety goggles, and ear protection. Over the safety goggles, he had another pair of magnifying lenses which made his eyes nearly vanish behind their curve. Whatever he was working on shrieked and threw sparks into the air. This, by the way, is one of the reasons we stopped using pure oxygen in space. Well, that and the dangers of oxygen toxicity from long-term exposure. Leonard looked up when I came into the lab and slapped the off switch on his contraption, smiling.
"York, what can I do for you?"
I waited until he had slipped the earmuffs back to rest around his neck like an odd tie. "There's some stuff I want to talk to you about, but I want to wait until Florence gets here."
"About?"
"The FBI." His face went gray. He slipped the goggles up on top of his head and wiped his hands off on a rag on the lab table.
"I'll shut things down."
Holding up my binder, I shrugged. "I brought something to work on until she gets here. She said it would be another 20 minutes or so."
"Well, I'm not going to get anything useful done in 20 minutes.
He threw the rag back on the table.
"This just isn't going to go away, is it?"
"I don't know." Leonard pulled the earmuffs from around his neck and clipped them onto their spot on the rack of tools. Both sets of goggles followed before he turned his attention back to the contraption on the table. "What are you working on?" I sat down on one of the lab stools next to the counter.
"Testing a new core sampler."
He backed it out of the rock he'd been drilling into.
"I'm not a fan. It has too much play and it doesn't really cut a clean hole. But I guess some corporation wants us to use it and they're backing some aspect of the mission. You know how it goes. Our drill bits are used on Mars."
I snorted. Yeah, I've got people wanting me to take their lipstick on the expedition.
You're kidding.
He stopped with the drill in one hand, then shook his head.
Don't bother. I know the answer.
Behind me, Florence asked,
The answer to what?
I turned to her. Have you been asked to take cosmetics to Mars? Florence had changed out of her tracksuit, but her hair was still pulled back into a tight bun. She rolled her eyes.
Hair straightener. As if I'm going to use lion space. That stuff burns enough when you have gravity to keep it in place.
Wait, you use lye to straighten your hair? Florence waved her hand as if to wipe my question out of the air.
I stopped my run early, so tell me why I did.
Right. I set my binder on the counter and took a breath. Before becoming an astronaut, I probably would have beaten around the bush and taken my time, being careful to hedge my statements. Now, I wouldn't insult my teammates by wasting their time with anything but the information they needed to work the problem. The South African reporter. He mentioned having a source. The FBI agents did, too. So, I wondered if it might be De Beer.
Of course it is.
Florence sat down on one of the stools and set a squeezed pouch of water on the counter.
Is that all you wanted to talk about?
Well, what are we going to do about it? Leonard and Florence exchanged looks. He shook his head.
Exactly what I've been doing. Keeping my head down and trying not to cause trouble.
But he's making things up, like the reporter said that you had gone on an EVA before the rocket left.
And I did.
My jaw dropped. Leonard rubbed his forehead.
Look, I talked to the FBI about it, and they confirmed with Maloof, who was on the EVA with me, as well as with Mission Control, that we were nowhere near the rocket.
Good. I tried again to make them understand what was happening. But De Beer is trying to get you kicked off the mission.
We know, Florence sighed. It's why we're careful not to spend too much time together, or with Camilla and Terrazas, for that matter. Don't want him to think the darkies are colluding.
So let's talk to Mission Control and...
No!
Leonard straightened.
For the love of God Almighty, do not talk to Mission Control. I had a devil of a time convincing Clemens to keep me on after that mess with the FBI, and I am not going to rock the boat now.
I turned to Florence for support, and she shook her head at me.
I know you mean well, but he's right. You know I'm outspoken as all get out when I'm not happy, but there's no way I would go to Mission Control with this.
I slumped on my stool. There had to be something we could do. What they were saying sounded a lot like Helen's reasons for agreeing to bow out of the mission because the IAC wanted to send me instead. For that matter, it wasn't that far out from why Mama had always told me to be quiet and polite. As a young Jewish woman, I couldn't afford to give people any reason to notice me. I gnawed my lower lip. What if we spin it so it isn't about you? Is there a way I could use my whole lady astronaut thing to point out that De Beer is a problem? I mean, I can rock the boat. They won't do anything to me. Leonard tilted his head to the side and squinted like he was Superman trying to see through lead. Then he shook his head, straightening.
Nope, it'll still blow back on me. You want to help, and I appreciate that, but I'm going to have to ask you to let it lie. Once we're underway, De Beer will be on the other ship, and it won't matter.
Florence smiled bleakly.
This will be the only time that apartheid works in our favor.
At my puzzled glance, she shrugged.
You didn't know? We're on the separate but equal ship.
One of the unexpected benefits of living in the meteor age was that telephone service had drastically improved with the advent of satellites. Telephone companies no longer had to string wires across the entirety of the United States or drag long transatlantic cables below the ocean. Instead, radio dishes bounced the signals up into space, where a satellite caught them and bounced them back down to a dish on another part of the planet. The technology had been developed to allow us to communicate with Earth on the way to the moon, then refined for communication with Lunetta, and further refined for the Mars expedition. All of which meant that once a week, despite being on an orbital platform, I got to talk to my husband. I tethered myself at one of the cubbies in Lunetta's comm module. The chamber hung off one of the weightless limbs of the station like a barnacle made of antenna. Pulling the headphones from their clip on the side of the cubby, I tried not to listen in on the other conversations happening in the little room. The other four public phones were in use by two crew members from Lunetta, one reporter, and a miner en route to the moon. With the earphones settled on my head, the other conversations dulled behind a faint buzz of static. I toggled the line to let the operator know I was there, and waited until her voice broke the static. British this time.
What number, please?
Kansas West, 65309. It was Nathaniel's desk phone, since it was still early afternoon in Kansas.
One moment.
The line clicked and buzzed as she made the connection, and a moment later it rang. The phone didn't even get through the first ring.
Nathaniel York speaking.
Hello, handsome.
Hi.
How can he put so much sweetness into a single syllable? How is it that I can melt and turn into jelly just at the sound of his voice? The difference between when he answers the phone professionally and when he answers me is like the difference between a practical slide rule and a kitten, which is probably the strangest analogy I'll ever make, but it's true. I pulled the microphone closer and leaned my head against the wall of the cubby, pretending that it was his shoulder. I've missed you.
Yeah, me too.
The desk fan whirred behind his voice.
How's it going up there?
This was where I wanted to tell him about De Beer, and my conversation with Leonard and Florence. But I was in a room with other people, and he was on the company line. Okay. My husband heard the hesitation, I think.
Just okay?
Long days. Plus, there's a gaggle of reporters up here. There, I could talk about that. You know how much I enjoy having reporters around. He chuckled a little.
I know. But I've got to admit, I like the fact that I'm getting to see the occasional photo of you.
At least none of them are asking me to pose with a punch card.
The one of you flying down a corridor was pretty sweet.
The phone rustled as he shifted.
How are you holding up?
Ready to be finished with training, honestly. If it weren't for the orbital trajectories, I think De Beer would take his team out now and try to beat us to Mars. I cleared my throat. He's an... interesting man?
Oh?
Listening to my husband, I could almost see the lift of his brows and the way he tapped a pencil on the desk when he thought.
Say, Elma, I hate to ask you about work on our personal call, but did you need to run a teletype test in the next day or so?
Bless him. I'd been trying to figure out a way to do that on my own and couldn't come up with anything. But being married to the lead engineer meant that he could, very occasionally, flex the schedule for me. And yet, if I told him what was going on with De Beer, he would do something about it. I might as well just broadcast it to Mission Control and ignore Florence and Leonard. Exhaling, I bit the inside of my cheek before answering. I think I'm okay.
You sure?
Yeah. I wasn't, and he knew that. But he couldn't fix anything that was troubling me. Promise. I'll let you know if I need to run a test.
You do that.
Oh, God. There was so much reluctance in his voice, and I wanted to reassure him that everything was all right. And for me, it was. My teammates, not so much. I tried to put a smile in my voice and change the subject. How about you? Win any more olives at poker?
Alas, no. And I'm afraid that I had to relinquish a jar of pickled onions to Renard last time. He and Helen say hello, by the way.
Give my regards back. Everyone misses Helen up here. I had caught up a lot over the past year, but that didn't make up for how long she had been training with them, or the injustice of the way she had been treated. The line hissed between us. Sometimes the weight of longing to be with him effectively silenced me. It wasn't the longing itself, but that everything I wanted to say got tangled up in one phrase. I miss you.
Me too.
He sighed.
Oh, I'm getting an intern next summer.
Really? I thought you hated interns. What prompted that?
He's smart and dedicated, and his aunt is my wife.
I lifted my head fast enough that the movement started me spinning in the cubby. Putting a hand out to stop myself, I laughed. You stinker! You didn't open with that? When? How did that happen? He laughed, and warmth filled the space between us like the sun coming out.
Tommy wrote a very nice, extremely formal letter. Addressed me as Dr. York, even.
How do you know it wasn't addressed to me?
Ha! Point. The envelope said Dr. Nathaniel York, so I figured that narrowed it down. Anyway, he's putting together his university applications and wants some practical experience on his application form. Astronomy, he says. So he's looking at Berkeley, Wyoming, and Hawaii.
I'll visit him in Hawaii.
Nathaniel chuckled. That's what I said. Anyway, he's going to come stay with me and sleep on the sofa.
I gave a little whistle trying to imagine that. Tommy was sweet, but still a teenage boy, and our apartment was snug with just two of us. Of course, I wouldn't be there. So it'll be a bachelor pad?
Something like that.
I'm picturing you fellas leaving your socks everywhere. TV dinners, poker nights.
I had dancing girls and cigars in mind.
Don't you corrupt my nephew, Nathaniel Ezra York. I wound the cord of the headset around my hand. The rough cloth was a cold substitute for my husband. They've got enough on their hands with Rachel.
Yeah, I guess so. Any news there?
The last letter I had from Herschel said they were sending her to a boarding school. I didn't want to share the full contents of the letter with everyone floating in the other cubicles, although it wouldn't draw the same sort of attention that conversations about the Mars expedition team might. Apparently, she stole a ring from Aunt Esther and sold it at a pawn shop. In my ear, Nathaniel whistled with astonishment. They got it back, thank God, and grounded her again, but she snuck out to be with that boy. I don't know what's going on with her. Herschel says that Doris is just beside herself, feeling like she's failed as a parent.
She only has to look at Tommy to know that's not true.
Nathaniel's breath in the headphones as he sighed reminded me how far away he was.
Sometimes people make inexplicable decisions, but Rachel is her own person, and those decisions are hers. Maybe boarding school will give her the space to start making better choices.
He would have made such a good father. I closed my eyes to keep the sudden surge of tears behind my lids. Crying in zero gravity was such a hassle. The tears couldn't fall, so they just built up in a salty hemisphere around your eyes that all but blinded you. Well, take good care of Tommy when he gets there.
I will.
He chuckled.
Although I've been instructed to call him Thomas when he's out here for the internship. He's worried that Tommy seems too childish for a college-bound young man.
I lifted my arm to press the cuff of my shirt against my eyes, soaking away the tears that were collecting there. 3 years. In 3 years, where would they all be? 12.
Wide racial plot hinted at in Cygnus 14 crash. Johannesburg, South Africa, September 19th, 1962. The belief is growing among moderate leaders in the United States that a National Association for the Advancement of Colored People group of at least 20 persons plotted the crash of the Cygnus 14 rocket. According to sources within the International Aerospace Coalition, some of the conspirators are astronauts themselves. Speaking under the condition of anonymity, an IAC employee said that the Negro astronauts have been under close scrutiny by agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation since the crash. What bothers me most, he said, is the unwillingness of so many people at the IAC to face the facts that this was premeditated. It wasn't an accident.
I slid down the ladder from the sleeping quarters in the weightless center of Luneta and into the ring that circled the station. The transition from zero-G to gravity wasn't as rough as returning to Earth. You got heavier as you slid down the ladder, in sort of the same way as when you let all the water out of the tub while you're still in it. Or maybe I'm the only one who does that. Anyway, I usually take a moment at the bottom of the ladder to get my bearings before I walk away from it. But on my way to the Monday morning staff meeting, I could hear shouting even before I hit the bottom of the ladder. My feet slapped against the rubber floor, and I spun toward the conference room. The turn was too fast, and I had to throw out a hand to steady myself on the ladder as the Coriolis effect caught me. One of the many reasons we use the mantra, slow is fast, in space.
No proof that it was me!
De Beer's voice belted out of the conference room and down the long, curving halls. Parker responded, loud enough that his voice carried, but not so loud that I could understand him. What on earth? I sprinted toward the conference room. Behind me, I heard someone else land at the bottom of the ladder.
It's a newspaper article. Am I to be blamed for everything coming out of South Africa?
Van, cool it.
Binkowski's easy voice met me at the door.
That's not what he's saying.
Some of the astronauts were already in the room, along with cups of coffee and imported donuts. Parker stood at the head of the table with his hands resting on either side of the briefing reports. His face was red, and a vein bulged on the side of his neck, but his voice was tightly controlled.
What I am saying is this.
He slid a page forward.
And other news articles like it can cause the mission to be canceled or pushed back, which is the same thing, given the current economic climate.
I had nothing to do with it.
De Beer had his arms crossed over his chest and was trying to look down his nose at Parker.
Then you have no reason to object when I say that from here on, any contact with reporters will be in the company of an IAC representative.
Parker scanned the room, his gaze resting briefly on me.
That applies to everyone, including me.
So, I am not allowed to speak to a fellow countryman. Is this what you are telling me?
If that countryman is a reporter, yes.
De Beer looked as if he wanted to spit on the floor.
I am going to object to the IAC.
The order comes from Clemens. Parker shrugged. So you can do that if you want to, but it's not going to go well for you.
He will take the easy route, when his focus should be on the charges brought up in the article.
De Beer flicked his fingers toward Leonard, who sat in the back of the room with his head down and his hands knotted together in his lap. Tarazis and Heidi entered the room, both with the same "what the" expression on their faces. Whatever was going on, it had nothing to do with Nathaniel or me. Hopefully. What charges? De Beer spun toward me with a sardonic smile.
The IAC is trying to cover up the involvement of a Negro astronaut in the crash of the Cygnus 14 rocket.
They can't cover up something that didn't happen. I crossed my arms over my chest to match him. We were both there, so you should know it didn't. His smile faltered as if he suddenly remembered who he was talking to.
Yes. Yes, we were. But you were at the front of the rocket. So you may not also remember that Dr. Flannery spent much time in whispered conversation with the terrorists.
No one remembers that because it didn't happen. Although he was right. If Leonard had been talking with any of the protesters while I was at the door of the plane, acting as their go-between, I wouldn't know. But I was confident that Leonard had not been involved. I turned my back on De Beer. Are there still donuts? Raphael leaned against the built-in plastic counter and gestured to the vacuum-packed pastries.
Straight off the last supply ship. They almost taste fresh.
Joining in the effort to change the subject, Tarazis gave a short laugh.
You've been up here too long if you think that's fresh.
Parker sat down, tapping his pages like he was Clemens.
Let's get down to business, people. We're a month out from launch, and we need to be on task.
1 month. And we had only a 7-day window for departure, or we'd have to put the mission off for another year and a half while the planets came back into alignment. De Beer would have to be an idiot to keep trying to get Leonard kicked off the flight. I prayed that he wasn't an idiot. I grabbed a packaged donut and a cup of coffee. One of the early problems with being in space was that the congestion in sip packs meant you couldn't really smell the coffee, which took half the joy out of it. It was just bitter water. Bitter water with caffeine, but still. The centrifugal ring made all the difference. If you think this isn't important, then you have no understanding of how much of the space industry is fueled by coffee. I inhaled the redolent steam as I headed to an empty seat between Raphael and Camilla. The Niña crew tended to sit together on the left side of the table, while the Pintas sat on the right. It wasn't really planned, but we also tended to sit more or less opposite our counterpart. So I nodded to Heidi Fogelli as I settled in my chair. She nodded back and jerked her head toward De Beer at the front of the table. In the sigh that followed, I read a certain amount of commiseration. At the front of the table, Parker gave everyone time to settle as he sipped his own coffee. Setting the cup down, he gave a brisk nod.
This week, we're focused on inventorying supplies and making sure they're secured. The Lynetta crews have been ferrying them over and loading the ships for us, but we want to make sure it's all really there.
Can't run out to the store for a gallon of milk on the way to Mars.
Binkowski winked. Parker ignored him and carried on.
The Nina team will be Terrazas, Avellino, and Flannery. Meanwhile, I want Shamoon to check the medical supplies. Gray and York, you're on the kitchen.
I was so terribly surprised that he had the women doing inventory on the kitchen. What could possibly have caused him to assign us there?
Painter team will be DeBeer, Schoenhaus, and Stuman. Donaldson is checking the medical bay and supplies. Kitchen duty is Sabados and Fogeli.
Donaldson, Fogeli, and Sabados were sitting next to each other on the Pinta's side, as if they might get their girl cooties on the men of the mission. Fogeli leaned over and whispered something to Sabados, who pursed her lips to hide a smile.
Binkowski, you and I will be on busy bee duty to ferry people across to the ships, then to do a full checklist inspection of the bees.
Parker looked up from his papers.
Mission Control thinks this will take us 6 hours, and they want us back on Luneta in time for a press conference this evening.
Down the table, Rafael snorted. I knew what he meant. If everything were under gravity, then sure, 6 hours might be adequate. But it would take a half hour on each end just to go from Luneta to the ships in the Busy Bees. To say nothing of suiting up. And a press conference after a full day doing inventory? Ugh. I bit into the donut, and it was made of styrofoam. The sugar on the outside had a slight plastic character from the packaging. They had better have snacks at the press conference. Parker let us grumble for a moment before giving a lopsided smile.
I told them that was unreasonable, so we've got 2 days. But the press conference is still this evening.
Ruby Donaldson, the Pinta's medic, lifted her coffee.
Bless you, Father.
Parker shook his head.
Just a reminder that no one is to speak to any of the reporters without an IAC representative present. Talk to Betty if you need assistance.
DeBeer muttered something in Afrikaans and drew a harsh line across a page in his binder. Parker leaned forward,
heard, and understood. Why don't you say that in English for the rest of the group?
DeBeer turned red and ground his teeth together. Then he shrugged.
If we need Betty, will we find her in your bunk?
The room went quiet, uncovering the constant hush of fans that was our backdrop on Luneta. We all knew about the affair. We all knew that Betty and Parker had continued it on the station. But they were discreet. None of us said anything about it because, frankly, Parker was nicer when he was getting laid. Parker kept his gaze set on DeBeer.
Thank you for sharing with the class. I'll note, for the record, that the Afrikaans word whore means just what it sounds like. Whore is a harsh thing to call any journalist, no matter how annoying the press conferences are. These folks have jobs to do, same as we do. And cooperating with them gets it done faster. Is cooperating what they're...
Florence stopped and cleared her throat.
Is cooperating what the journalists are doing when they ask questions about the colored crew members? That topic is closed.
Parker pulled his attention back to his papers, ignoring Florence's scoffing huff.
As a heads up for next week, this is a reminder that Mission Control is sending a team up for last looks before departure. Slight change in staffing there, as they've added our lead engineer to that team.
Nathaniel. The room went hot. Everyone turned to look at me, and I wanted to melt under the table. No one else would get to see their family before we left. He shouldn't have made that change, and yet I was so very, very glad he did.
York, you'll meet that rocket with Betty. Be aware that the press corps will be there, so I recommend talking with her ahead of time for any tactical advice.
Parker grinned like a shark.
As a note, the Busy Bees are soundproof.
I hate him so much. I grabbed the Fibonacci sequence and clung to it so I didn't lunge across the table and slap him. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13. Across the table, Heidi glared at me with naked anger. Oh, Nathaniel, I had just gotten people to accept me as part of the team and not some interloper here for publicity reasons. Why had Clemens said yes? They had to know what this would do to morale. While my face flamed out, DeBeer leaned toward Binkowski.
See, I told you they were the publicity ship.
Binkowski, who had known me for years, had a sour smile on his face, like he was trying not to scowl at me. He laughed.
Yeah, well, York's always been good at publicity.
We all have our jobs to do.
Parker's shark smile was still fixed, showing all his perfect teeth.
York, you'll have the morning off to make sure you can look real pretty to greet the old man. The press will love that.
I floated next to the airlock in one of the weightless sections of Luneta as the latest rocket from Earth arrived. In training, on the station, I had fallen into the rhythms of my crewmates. When Parker had told me that Nathaniel was coming, the date hadn't occurred to me. Nathaniel would be here for Rosh Hashanah. Everyone was setting up for a dry run of the departure over on the ships. Well, everyone except for me, Betty, and the entire press corps. They all floated at my back, comfortable with zero-G after repeated trips up to the space station, taking away seats from real astronauts. One of the station crew kicked off with his toes and flew to the hatch where he double-checked the pressure, then peered through the portal for visual confirmation. Just because the delta pressure gauge was at 4.9 didn't mean that there was necessarily something on the other side of this door. It could be a short. After a moment, he pumped the ratchet handle and hauled the airlock door back. Inside, the hatch for the shuttle swung open and released a brief whiff of Earth. I'm sure this is my imagination because my sense of smell is terrible in space, but it seems as if the air coming off of a flight from Earth smells different than the clinical recycled air we get up here. Passengers filed out, and the crew greeted the ones they knew. Most of them were en route to the moon or coming up for rotation on Luneta. Once the astronauts were out, the team from Mission Control floated through the airlock. Bubbles, Michael Boundy, Ken Harrison, and Howard Tang. All white men, except for Tang. And at the back, the very last person off the rocket, grinning like he was about to burst into tears, was my husband. With the photographers at my back, I plastered my regulation smile on over every bit of joy and grief in my soul. Welcome to Luneta, gentlemen. The crew will stow your personal luggage while I zip you over to the Nina and Pinta in one of the busy bees. Behind me, the plummy British voice of the reporter from the Times called out,
Dr. York, how does it feel to see your wife?
Swell.
Nathaniel kicked closer to the front of the group, moving awkwardly. He'd been in space before, but it had been a couple of years. It took him two tries to get his foot hooked under one of the guide rails. Bubbles managed to bounce even while holding onto a rail.
Go on and kiss her! You'll be useless until you do!
This was, I think, the only time in my life I have ever been reluctant to kiss my husband. The moment I did, all of the cameras would click and clatter and snap at once. I knew the system well enough by this point to know that every major paper on Earth would carry a photo of us kissing. But as Parker so kindly pointed out, we all had a job to do, and mine was to make space and Mars look inviting to the women of Earth. My paperwork might say computer, but I was a poster girl for the stars. Still smiling, I pushed off with my toes and translated to the guide rail by my husband. Nathaniel's warmth radiated off of him. I inhaled, but the scent of him lay hidden behind the congestion of zero gravity. Shy as a new bride, I smiled up at my husband of 12 years. Hello, Dr. York.
Dr. York, it's very fine to see you.
Nathaniel took my hand in his, and I found the callus on his index finger. He leaned in to whisper,
Lashana Tova, Tikatevi, Vita Chatemi.
We wouldn't have a formal dinner or hear chauffeur blasts or even have candles to light, but we could at least greet each other for the new year. I whispered back, Lashana Tova, Tikatev, Vita Chatem. He smiled and then nodded at the crowd behind us.
May I?
I bit my lower lip and nodded. 3.141. He bent, eclipsing the hangar and the reporters and the engineers and Betty and Earth and everything. My husband tasted a fresh mint and his own inscrutable self. His cheeks were baby soft, except for that tiny patch of bristle right under his lip that he always missed. Pulling back, my cheeks burned as the engineers broke into applause and cheers. Lights snapped and flashed around us. I clung to Nathaniel's hand for a moment longer, trying to draw in an even breath. 3.141592. As my therapist had taught me, lo, those many years ago, I forced a breath out until my lungs were empty and the inhalation followed almost naturally. Nathaniel rested his free hand on my lower back and cleared his throat.
Right. I think the IAC allotted 4.5 minutes for greetings, and we have a timetable to keep.
That got a laugh from the gallery, including some members of the Lunetta crew who were hanging around to see Nathaniel. I released my husband's hand and slipped back. If you'll follow me, the busy bee is right this way. The Mars expedition teams are looking forward to seeing all of you. I shouldn't be working during Rosh Hashanah, but at least I wasn't alone. Nathaniel split his team between the ships. I don't know who made the decision, but Nathaniel inspected the Pinta, rather than my ship, along with Bubbles, sending the rest to look at the Nina. Again, I don't know who made the decision, but I did notice that Tang was assigned to our separate but equal ship. The day was long and as boring as you could hope for from an inspection. I think the most exciting moment was when Tang found Hafael's chocolate stash and threatened to inspect it. Our team was solid, at least as far as the work was concerned. I didn't get Nathaniel to myself until after the inspections and a group dinner and yet another press conference. When I did, I pulled him into the busy bee. The tiny ship was little more than a shielded tube with an engine and seats. To be sure, it had life support, but it was designed for carrying people in airless space and would never survive re-entry. I activated the fans that circulated air with the main station and shut the hatch, sealing us in. Nathaniel floated behind me and pulled me back into his chest. He wrapped his arms around me, burying his face against my neck. My whole body ached from missing him. His breath warmed my cheek and stirred the fine hairs at the nape of my neck.
How bad is the Jabir situation?
I turned in his arms, which set us both to rotating slowly in the aisle of the busy bee. That's why you're here. Nathaniel gave a familiar smirk and found the zipper of my flight suit.
Well, there are other reasons, too.
I rolled my eyes at him, even while my engine was priming. And here I thought you were up for Rosh Hashanah.
That was a happy coincidence of timing.
He ran his thumb along the edge of my collarbone.
As you know, I'm a terrible Jew.
How are you going to survive 3 years?
Don't know.
He sighed, then his foot caught one of the chairs, stopping his rotation.
Tell me about Dabir.
Mine kept going for a moment, spinning me past him. With one hand, I gripped his upper arm and anchored myself. I don't think he'll be a problem once we leave. I mean, he can still be an asshole, but there won't be the opportunities for mischief that he has currently.
Yeah, I wish South Africa had sent us someone else.
Nathaniel tugged at the zipper of my suit, letting in some welcome cool.
At least he's just the co-pilot of the Pinta.
Binkowski will keep him in check, I hoped. Sliding my free hand across Nathaniel's shoulder, I sought the buttons of his shirt. I told you that I was fine.
And then the South African newspaper article came out, and everything surrounding the black astronaut started up again.
Clemens, tell me you didn't talk to him about this. Nathaniel leaned in and nuzzled the bare skin below my collarbone.
How do you think I got rotated back onto the inspection team?
If I'd wanted you to... Wait. What do you mean, back on? He pushed the flight suit aside to bare my shoulder. Slipping a finger under my bra strap, he grimaced a little.
Ah. When you got assigned to the Mars mission, there was a general consensus that our relationship might cause me to have confused priorities relating to the mission.
Clearly they don't know you.
No, they do know me. I would sacrifice everyone on both ships to keep you safe.
He pushed the bra strap to the side, followed it down to the cup, and then dipped inside it to cradle my breast. I need you to not make exceptions for me.
I try not to, but it's not actually possible.
It's why we pulled Carmouche from a lot of the work when Helen was tapped for the mission.
Please. Pulling myself closer to Nathaniel, I kissed his neck. Here, with my face pressed against my husband, I could finally get a faint whiff of his familiar scent. It makes things harder with the team if there's favoritism. Nathaniel tugged the other sleeve of my flight suit down with no grace or finesse. We spun away from the seats, drifting down the center aisle of the Busy Bee.
I was only allowed up because Clemens knows that after you, there is nothing more important to me than seeing the crew to Mars and safely back.
I pulled my hands free of my sleeves, shivering a little in the cool air, or maybe shivering because my husband was running his hands down my back, around my sides, up past my breasts, and then repeating the orbit. How can a person be cold and overheated at the same time? We have a conflict, then, because for me, seeing the crew to Mars and safely back is more important than just me. Nathaniel lifted his head.
Is it more important than me?
God help me, I hesitated. His eyes widened and he laughed.
Well, I guess I should have expected that.
No! I caught both of his hands and brought them to my lips. It's not that. It's that I can't imagine a situation where I would have to make that choice. Your life or theirs? You might.
Yes.
His blue eyes searched mine. I don't know what he was looking for.
I might. Forgive me.
Rosh Hashanah is a time of forgiveness and atonement. It is a time of joy and reflection. The rest of our conversation was all of those and conducted without spoken language, though it was not necessarily silent. At least Parker was right. The Busy Bee was soundproof. 13.
14 astronauts speed toward Mars at 36,000 miles per hour. By John Noble Wilford, special to the National Times. Kansas City, Kansas, October 19th, 1962. The 14 astronauts of the first Mars expedition soared through the black emptiness of space tonight on their way to man's first rendezvous with Mars. For those on Earth, when the three ships of the Mars fleet fired their mighty engines, they appeared to be bright stars circling the night sky in tight symmetry. Their ignition marks the beginning of man's most far-reaching journey yet. After they completed nearly two orbits to build up their speed to a blistering 36,000 miles per hour, the fleet's booster rockets fired to send the crafts out of Earth orbit and toward Mars. It will take the astronauts 320 days to reach the red planet.
Do you remember where you were when the first Mars expedition left Earth orbit? I have been told that a quarter of the people alive on Earth watched on televisions or through telescopes or listened to us on the radio. 100% of the people on the moon did. There were cameras in the command module to record our voyage for posterity. Farther out, they would not transmit a clear picture, but for the departure, the people of Earth got to watch us go about our business, intercut with commentary from Walter Cronkite. I had been in the NavComp seat before. I sat at the window with my sextant and charts, my pencil and graph paper, and outside, darkness. Darkness and the Earth, that spinning globe of luminescent blues and whites and the sparkle of cities, like stars scattered upon the ground. And somewhere below the clouds was my husband. The comm crackled and Maloof came on the line as Capcom.
Ninja One, Kansas?
Parker toggled on the comm.
Go ahead, Kansas. Ninja One.
Okay. Coming up on 3 hours and 15 minutes as per flight plan. We have you go.
Roger. Go.
Parker grinned and glanced around the cabin at us. Sure, we were professionals, but this was the call to launch us away from Earth.
You can expect that the SIVB will be 10 degrees off in pitch at SEP attitude. However, that is go. There is no problem involved.
Roger.
He toggled off the mic and glanced over at me.
You got that?
Confirmed. I updated my notations in the nav manual. A 10-degree pitch difference fell into the category of minor and expected things. Heck, we'd run sims where it was further off than that. But if we didn't start taking it into account now, the error would muddy all the data downstream. I was the redundancy in case we lost touch with Earth and their computers. Around me, the rest of the crew did their assigned tasks while I busied myself with the mathematics of space. Numbers danced beneath my fingers like stars in the sky. Maloof came on the line again.
Ninja 1, Kansas. We would like to ask whether you did a verb 66 enter to transfer the state vector from MSM to MM slot. We didn't copy that down here.
Florence looked up from the mechanical computer where she was mirroring my work.
I haven't done that yet.
Parker frowned. We did not.
Okay.
Okay? That was it? I held my pencil poised over the paper. Does he want us to do that now? It's not on the schedule until...
Do you want us to do that now?
At your convenience.
Roger.
Parker toggled the mic off.
Got that, Gray?
Confirmed.
She scribbled a number on a tablet to the side of the toggles for the mechanical computer. The idea was that if we lost contact with Earth and something happened to me, the mechanical computer could function as a backup, but it could only hold about 30 operations in its memory. Why they wanted us to update it now, I couldn't tell you, but the ways of mission control were sometimes mysterious. I leaned toward Florence. Need any help?
She shook her head. I've got a breather on the radio until they want to test the VHF, and my memory of the Sims is that you'll be pretty busy for the next...
Ninja 1, Kansas. We would like to have an approximate GET of your SEP maneuver to use for our ephemeris tracking data.
I rolled my eyes. On the ground, they sometimes forgot how long it took to actually do things. If they'd been relying on the mechanical computer, Florence would still be keying in data. I tried not to sound smug as I beat her to the answer. 3 hours, 40 minutes, 0 seconds. Parker raised an eyebrow.
You didn't even look that up.
That's why I get paid the big bucks. Parker repeated the GET to Maloof. Down on Earth, the folks in Mission Control would be conferring on the data we sent to make sure everything was calibrated and on track. Toggling the occasional switch, Parker watched his gauges.
Got anything for Kansas York?
I've got the exact call out here for you, and a burn status report. I nodded without looking up from my paper. Poor Florence over at the mechanical contraption was still keying in the numbers. It might calculate faster, but that's only if you didn't count the time it took to program the damn thing. Delta VX minus 00011. Delta VY plus 0002. Delta VZ minus 0002. Roll 0, pitch 180, yaw 0. Parker repeated all of that to the ground while I went back to updating the nav plans. Granted, ground control should just send us the updated information, but I needed to have things already in place in case we lost communications.
God damn it.
Terrazas leaned toward the window and then sat back in his seat, shaking his head.
Inertia's got the SIVB traveling right on our tail.
That was the rocket that had pushed us up to full velocity for the trip. I grimaced and met Terrazas' gaze. This is going to be like the moonshot again. Parker, can you get us away from it? Otherwise, the starfield will be obscured when it vents.
Swell. Parker shook his head. I'll have to do a couple of small maneuvers to stay away from the SIVB.
Too late. Outside my window, the stars seemed to multiply into hundreds of thousands of little fireflies. Caught in the light, the frozen propellant sparkled like stars, and my job suddenly got hundreds of thousands of times harder, just like it had on the moon mission. Fortunately, I had a lot of practice at struggling to identify stars. Parker sighed and toggled mission control.
Kansas, Ninja 1. The SIVB is venting, and it's right on our tail.
Roger, understand. That is supposedly a non-propulsive vent. The big blowdown maneuver starts at 044455, and the vent occurs at 050755.
Terrazas snorted.
Non-propulsive maybe, but it's like a geyser.
Maloof asked,
how far away from the SIVB are you now?
Between 150 and 300 meters.
Okay, Parker. On your additional separation maneuver, we recommend that you make a radial burn. Point your plus X axis toward Earth and thrust minus X for 0.91 meters per second. Over.
I don't want to do that. I'll lose sight of the SIVB.
Okay. The reason we want a radial burn is to increase your mid-course correction so we can use the SPS. Stand by on it.
I lifted my head. We don't need to do that. Right now our gimbal angles are about... rolls about 190, pitch about 320, and yaws about 340. We could do it in this position.
Nenya 1, Kansas. Where are you relative to the booster?
Parker studied me for a second before he responded.
We are directly above the SIVB with the sun on the right side of the booster and visible in our left number one window.
As soon as he toggled off the mic, he turned to me.
Get those numbers ready for me. They're going to ask.
Copy. I nodded and set the numbers down on the page to describe the model of the ship I held in my head. I was fully an adult before I realized that other people did not relate to numbers the way I did. For them, they are abstract shapes on a page that, at best, relate to a physical number of objects. For me, they have form and definition and mass and texture and color. I could hold the ship and the SIVB and Mars and Earth in my head until the impurities burnished away and only the pure, smooth calculus of space remained. Back on Earth, Maloof said,
Okay, understand. The sun is on the right side of the SIVB and coming in your number one window. And Aryo, when you give us those angles, that means that your plus X axis is pointed at it with those angles. Is that confirmed?
Confirmed. But York thinks we can do the burn without changing our gimbal angles.
I flipped to a reference page in my binder just to double-check my numbers. You can do a P-52 realign, and that should take care of it. The SIVB pitches about... It'll pitch about 10 degrees of its final attitude during the slingshot maneuver attitude. From her station, Florence punched a button on the mechanical computer and it began to clunk away with the snapping sound of vacuum tubes firing. Parker pursed his lips and nodded to Terrazas.
2.4 meters a second sound right to you?
That'll get us away and keep us lined up.
Terrazas leaned forward to look out his window.
It's still in the same position.
Nodding, Parker turned on the mic to mission control.
Kansas, we're going to have to hold up on the Sys-Mars navigation until after this next little maneuver.
Confirmed, Parker. We understand.
Behind Maloof, I could just make out the muted hum of voices in mission control. Even straining, I couldn't pick out Nathaniel's among them.
Can you give us an updated readout of your gimbal angles when your plus X axis is pointed toward the booster, please?
Stand by.
Parker turned over his shoulder to me.
Clear enough for you to get COAS on it?
Confirmed. I couldn't sight back on Earth's horizon, but if I put the shade on my sextant, the sun was an option.
Nenya 1, Kansas.
Go ahead, Kansas.